This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Alan Scott. Government actions meeting business decisions online at www.bgov.com and on the air Thursdays at 11 and Fridays at 2:30 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This week, we're bringing the world of technology into focus as we take a look at, and I'm doing the quotes, the cloud. The cloud. The proverbial cloud. There are those who call current sales tax laws outdated. Afzal Bari is a financial analyst with Bloomberg Government whose latest insight, outmoded sales tax confound cloud companies, examines the different ways you could purchase a product and how your sales tax could vary between them. Interesting stuff. He'll be up a little while later. Matt Caminiti is going to join us a little bit later to discuss R&D tax credits for those of you who don't have the money to get the ball rolling on that startup that you may have. Well, there's a vehicle out there you may be able to take advantage of, but is it coming? Is it going? I don't know. We'll have to figure that out with Matt in just a little while. But we'll begin the program with merger and acquisition activity in the cloud world. That's right. Increasingly, companies are kind of looking to expand their government business, and they've been turning their attention to the cybersecurity market. Soap and Shaw is a financial analyst with Bloomberg Government, focusing on the defense world, and she's written a study entitled Potential Targets, Companies in the Cloud and Mobile Security Attract Attention, and she's with us now to discuss. Hello, Soapin.
Hi, Alan.
You like my cloud? It's like kind of ominous.
I do like the quotes, yeah.
Yeah, the air quotes add weight, in case you didn't know. Anyway, the last couple of years, this cloud has kind of gotten a lot of attention, especially now that Apple has launched. You know, Apple kind of brought it to everybody, to the forefront. It's been there for a little while, but Apple kind of said, we've got this cloud and your phone, your everything that you have can now interact with it. Well, in an effort to entrench themselves in an emerging technology, so to speak, mergers and acquisitions are occurring around this cloud technology. I guess my question to you would be, what types of companies are kind of getting into this space at this point?
There are a number of contractors that are buying companies in the cloud space. So, for example, Dell just bought Quest. And Dell is a contractor. It also has a large commercial business. We're also seeing your defense prime contractors like Boeing, Raytheon, purchasing companies that have to do with cybersecurity, the topic that you mentioned earlier.
Right.
So when you have a cloud with a large amount of data, somebody has to protect that, especially for government purposes. So the federal government has been working to implement policies and sort of contracting procedures to enhance its ability to move email, other important functions to this cloud. And obviously, security is a priority. So by buying these smaller firms that have that security capability, you've got the bigger players boosting their business and offering that to the government.
It seems to me we're looking at a couple of different things here. Mm-hmm. Not only do we have companies trying to shore up their own wherewithal, so to speak, with sequestration looming. There are potential cuts that could come down the pike. This could further entrench themselves in an area that may or may not get cut, correct?
Exactly. And I'm glad you mentioned that because Leon Panetta, when he released the DoD strategic guidance in January of this year, he mentioned cybersecurity as an area where spending may continue, that, you know, the investment will be protected despite budget cuts. Now, obviously, sequester, we don't have the details on that.
Right.
But it is important to note that top officials have mentioned this as a priority.
OPM has kept their lips shut on that for the most part. So as companies are looking to expand, why are these cybersecurity companies so sought after? What's the big deal?
So it relates to the cloud portion that we talked about earlier. As the government moves more and more stuff, and I'm doing your air quotes.
Thank you.
To the cloud, there's a greater need for contractors to protect that data.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a company that can do that in a way that's proprietary and they have that special technology, they become really valuable. Similarly, there's been a shift towards mobile devices, bring your own device in the federal space. And also companies are doing this as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a commercial market as well. So in that space, again, there's a need to protect the network, protect the mobile device. And therefore, we've seen large companies acquiring smaller companies that have that proprietary security technology. So, for example, mm-hmm. Apple just agreed to buy Authentic, and they make the finger authentication sensors that go on mobile devices and personal computers. And so that's an area Apple is investing in. So you see an underlying trend, more mobile devices, and then you see the market impact of that, a growing market for mobile security, and then we see those acquisitions follow.
That's interesting. Research in Motion was huge in this for years, especially with the government. You look at any government employee and they all have a BlackBerry, so to speak. There has been, in the past year or so, a big push to get Apple into this space simply because the technology is a little bit better than what Research in Motion could offer. So to hear that they purchased Authentic is kind of interesting to see that the ball is actually rolling in that direction, at least from my perception.
And that's definitely the market perception as well.
Right. So overall, the market, it seems that the acquisitions and such has reached a lull. There's not really a lot going on. Chris Raymond, Executive Vice President of Development and Strategy for Boeing Defense, Space, and Security, said recently at that Farnborough Air Show, we've been looking for those different companies that have niche capabilities, going out trying to get them. They're not looking to get on those big contracts anymore. They want a bunch of these small cybersecurity contracts, from what it sounds. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, from what the executive said, that seems to be what they're looking for. And Boeing has an interesting history with cybersecurity. Their executives have said this is a priority area because of the reason that it may continue to receive funding. Mm-hmm. And they've made some recent acquisitions. Solutions Made Simple is one example that comes to mind that have to do with cybersecurity. And even more recently, they've started acquiring companies that relate to data analytics and the sort of broader information services umbrella, where you store large amounts of commercial government data and analyze it in a way that the end user can understand the important insights. And so they recently bought InMedius, and that acquisition helps bolster that capability. So they're looking at cybersecurity. They also seem to be looking at data analytics.
Right. Now, you kind of speculated that we talked about this yesterday a little bit. And in our conversation, your speculation with regard to what Chris Raymond had to say was kind of forward-looking. This is maybe what the future holds. How do you see this market playing out over the next few years?
So the cybersecurity market broadly, our data shows that it has been relatively flat for the past 5 years. Mm-hmm. There were, I think, $3.26 billion spent in 2011 by the government on cybersecurity. But there are these growing pockets, a few of which we've discussed already, such right. as, you know, the cloud security, mobile security. There are two reports, recent market research reports that came out that say the U.S. cloud computing market will grow at a compounded annual growth rate of almost 24% between now, 2012, and 2016. Another report they did said the worldwide mobile security market will grow at 30% over the same time period. Mm-hmm. So there are growth pockets, and I would assume that company executives, and they are saying this in earnings calls and the like, they are focusing in on those growth pockets within a broader market.
That makes sense. Will you come back and discuss more with us as everything starts to get buttoned up, more big mergers and acquisitions occur?
I would love to.
All right.
It happens all the time.
We'd love to have you back. I want to bring somebody else into the conversation now. His name is Afzal Bari. By the way, you're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Afzal, hey, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Good, good. You're a financial analyst with a focus on technology. I want to bring up something that I know that I have questions about. We're talking about sales tax. You wrote a study, an insight recently called Outmoded Sales Taxes Confound Cloud Companies. I'm looking at this as like the Wild Wild West right now. I mean, is that a fair assessment to call it the Wild Wild West? Because there really are no rules around it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's it's the Wild Wild West, but at the same time, some states have implemented rules, and they've done it in different various ways. So some of them have implemented rules via tax letters, you know, letter to a company that they've made public saying, well, you actually owe sales tax, or you have to collect sales tax. So those types of ways, which are not as transparent as, you know, enacting a law. So
I've heard statements from companies saying that, oh, we don't do sales tax because of Sarbanes-Oxley. Oh, we don't do sales tax because it's too complicated. Regardless of what the answer is, why do I care? What is it, what is the importance of this?
Sure, yeah. So if you're a company right now, and it depends on how you're providing the product or service when it comes to software. We're talking about technology here, right?
Right.
So the example that we use is TurboTax, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a consumer
perfect
walks...
example, because I purchased mine online.
Yeah,
so
and I think it's one that a lot of people are familiar with.
Right.
You walk into Best Buy and you purchase the CD version,
sure,
you're going to pay sales tax.
Of course.
If there's sales tax in that state, right? If you go online and you download a copy from Intuit's website, you're going to pay sales tax. They collect sales tax in all the states that they operate in. But if you go online and you actually use their online version where you're entering in the data onto their website, it depends. And part of it depends on different state rulings. But in certain states, for example, like in Arkansas, you can go online, download it, and you pay sales tax. But if you go online and you type in the information, you're doing the same thing. You don't owe sales tax because they've determined that it does under Arkansas's tax laws. It doesn't apply. So it makes it confusing, especially if you're a small company. I mean, Intuit's a pretty big company, and they specialize in taxes.
So they're going to be the ones to charge you the most whenever they can. Is that what you're saying? I'm not putting words in your mouth. Excuse me. So up to this point, we've really only addressed it state by state. There's nothing nationally. What's Congress doing about this? I know there are people that are up in arms because states could be making money. This is lost revenue from people coming from out of their borders to make purchases.
Sure. They're actually so two different issues. So one is downloading goods.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're downloading a piece of music, if you're downloading that software, and Congress does have a bill in the House that's supposed to address that. And then the other issue is actually with cloud taxation, and that they haven't done nearly as much. So when it comes to the downloading, the bill that's in the House right now, it's 1860.
Mm-hmm.
It says that states can't impose multiple or discriminatory taxes on digital downloads. So they can't charge you more for buying a CD off of iTunes than they could for you buying a CD by walking into a retail store.
Okay.
It still doesn't address some of the complexity issue. So the complexity issue of, well, is the digital download considered a tangible good or intangible good? And every state defines that very differently. So it doesn't really solve or harmonize the issue across state lines, but it does get to some action on that issue. With cloud, really, they haven't really been doing as much.
Right.
So, and then the third issue, which we haven't even talked about, is what happens if you buy TurboTax from a retailer like Amazon online, right?
Right.
And in that case, so for example, if you're in the state of Maryland, you would owe the sales tax, but Amazon's not going to collect it. Amazon doesn't collect sales tax for certain states. So Amazon wouldn't collect it, but you would still owe it, and it's your responsibility as a consumer to provide that to the state of Maryland. And as you can imagine,
in the form of a check.
Yeah, in the form of a check when you file your taxes.
Right.
And as you can imagine, compliance on those are called use taxes, mm-hmm, and all the sales taxes are called sales and use taxes. But when you as a consumer are doing it, it's a use tax, and compliance on that is pretty low.
How do states monitor what goods are sold within their jurisdiction?
Yeah, so they're having a hard time. There are a couple of different things. So Texas has... So Texas has actually taken a stance where they were trying to get Amazon to pay sales taxes as well. And a number of states have done that, where they've estimated the amount. But at the end of the day, it's about shipping. It's about what the shipping address is that the goods are coming into.
Out-of-state sales tax only to be collected if the retailer has an operation within the state where the purchase is being made. I think that might be the reason Amazon says, oh, just pay your own state. We don't have an office in every one.
Yeah.
And that's not a global policy, but that is a policy that a lot of states have kind of adopted.
Well, actually, so there's
companies, I should say.
There's a 1992 Supreme Court ruling, and it goes back to before there's, you know, the World Wide Web, people used to buy stuff off of catalogs, and it was a catalog company called Quill, which was trying to basically saying, I don't have operations in North Dakota, so I don't want to have to collect sales taxes for every single jurisdiction and then provide that to the state of North Dakota. And the Supreme Court agreed. The Supreme Court said, if you don't have operations in North Dakota, if you don't have operations in the state, you don't have to collect sales taxes for that. Because you don't have operations there.
I worked for a company recently that made a big switch to ensure that they could collect sales tax from anyone around the country. Gigantic undertaking. I would imagine there's a lot of money that's behind this that could be slowing it down as well.
Yeah, so the complexity is there. You know, there are over 3,000 counties. Mm-hmm. A lot of times states will have, each county will have its own tax rates. Sometimes it'll have state tax holidays where, you know, around here you can buy school supplies tax-free for a period of time. But if you're a retailer selling online, the complexity is there. And software will help, you know, cut through that complexity, but it's still there. So.
The insight is called Outmoded Sales Taxes Confound Cloud Companies. His name is Afzal Bari. Her name is Sopan Shah. Her latest piece of work is entitled Potential Targets. Companies in Cloud and Mobile Security Attract Attention. Both of you, thank you so much for joining me here on Capital Impact. You're listening to Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Alan Scott, joined now by Matthew Caminiti. Can I call you Matt?
You can call me Matt.
Very good.
Please
he's a BGov tax analyst and a bipartisan, bicameral Startup Innovation Credit Act of 2012 would allow innovative startups to access R&D tax credits. And Matt is here to talk about it. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Alan?
So far, so good. So this credit, originally presented back in 1981 to give people incentives to hire staff to perform R&D, you know, assist in funding startups. Pretty safe to say?
That's right.
All right. Tell us how it works.
Yeah, well, really, they're, you know, like you said, it's been in place since 1981. Really, when people, the R&D credit is sort of made up of several different credits. Mm-hmm. Usually when people talk about the R&D credit, they're talking about either the regular R&D credit or what's known as the alternative simplified credit. The alternative simplified credit was added later on basically as a way to try to help reduce some of the paperwork for smaller companies and get more people into the credit. One of the things businesses had said was that it was very complex and required a lot of administrative work and you know, in some cases may have, those costs may have offset the benefit of the credit, to some degree. So really, you know, you have sort of this regular and this alternative simplified credit. Mm-hmm. Both credits, give a company, a tax credit for really increasing their research and development activity. So in both cases, you have to figure out, a base amount mm-hmm. of R&D expense, and then you calculate your credit based off that base amount. So it's really talking about the how much are you increasing your R&D. Now, for a startup, there are provisions in the law that allow startups, you know, if you're undertaking R&D for the first time, there are ways that they can still claim that.
So this is more than just for a startup company. You're talking smaller companies, mid-sized companies could probably take advantage of this as well.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, some of the largest companies too, you know, companies, you know, such as Boeing, Pfizer, you know, pretty much any of the big you know, S&P 500 companies that you can think of and, you know, all the way down to some of the smaller shops.
So you just kind of answered my next question. You know, tech companies, software developers, software as a service companies, biotechnology, just about anybody is eligible for this, provided they provide the appropriate paperwork. And therein lies the key, because I feel as though if I were one of those companies, I'd be leaving myself open to an audit of sorts.
Yeah, that's always the possibility. So you do have to make sure you read the credit guidelines carefully and you know, make sure you understand which expenses qualify. And, you know, one of the most important things is that it's, you know, it's really for U.S. expenses. So it's R&D. The idea is to stimulate R&D investment in the U.S. So, you know, if you're a multinational company and you have operations overseas, in, you know, most cases, those activities probably aren't going to be eligible for the R&D credit. But a lot of other countries also have an R&D credit, you know, so it's something that companies can consider, you know, when they're deciding where to locate their, you know, either their investment or their research.
Are these other countries, and now I'm getting a little bit off topic here, but are those other countries' credits more valuable or substantial than the ones that are offered here in the U.S.?
In some cases, yes, and they also tend to, be permanent, or there's not that question of the constant question of, is this going to be renewed? Are we going to have this available to us mm-hmm. next year? So that is one of the things that U.S. businesses say, is that a lot of other countries are realizing the impact of an R&D credit, and are really putting these valuable credits in place, which in some cases rival or even better than U.S. credits, to try to attract the investment in the research.
So here I am trying to develop a widget, and I'm shopping for my R&D credit because, hey, I want an R&D credit. I'm eligible for it. I can fill out the paperwork. I can read. And a foreign country is coming to me going, hey, we can do this. What are the benefits of me staying in the U.S. with an R&D credit?
Well, I think with anything, depending on what kind of research you're undertaking, a lot of times it's the labor supply. If you need access to highly educated, workers and researchers, there are parts of the credit provide a credit for providing funding to universities for research and things like that. So, it's kind of the same issues that businesses face, whenever they're deciding where to locate operations, labor supply, educated workforce, mm-hmm. are they near their customers, things like that.
So you mentioned something that also would be a red flag for me. Hey, this credit just expired, or it's not here. What I know that they're in the midst of trying to figure something out right now with R&D credit. Tell me where we are with it at this point.
Yeah, so it's one of those things that it always gets a lot of support. Since it was enacted in 1981, it's been renewed 14 times. Five of those times it expired and then was reinstated retroactively, which mm-hmm. is actually where we're at now. So it expired at the end of 2011. There is bipartisan legislation to reenact it retroactively. There's legislation to extend it. There's legislation to make it permanent. There's legislation to maybe make the alternative simplified credit permanent. Even President Obama mm-hmm. has called for making the credit permanent and for actually increasing the percentage of the credit. So it would actually give companies, in some cases, a more valuable incentive. It's got bipartisan support. Max Baucus, who is head of the Senate Finance Committee, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and the ranking Republican, Senator Hatch, have both supported making the credit permanent and extending it. So, there's a lot of momentum behind it. Mm-hmm. And there's legislation that's moving through Congress now. And, I think a lot of businesses are keeping their fingers crossed that, as it has 14 times in the past, that it will be renewed.
I would say that there's a lot of, and I'm just speculating, there may be some weight behind somebody developing something new using an R&D credit, especially if that company may be ripe for acquisition. Are companies like that more ripe? We just had Sopin in talking about mergers and acquisitions, and now I'm thinking, hey, it almost like legitimizes my business. I now have an R&D credit. The government has said, oh yeah, we're going to get behind this. We're going to pay the salaries of the people who are doing the R&D work for you. Does that make them a little bit more interesting?
It may, it very well may. The fact that it's, the government, like you said, has said, yes, yeah, this is, profitable R&D. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, R&D credits on the books. It proves the technology has someone or something that they may want. What happens if the credit doesn't get renewed?
That's one of the things that businesses are constantly, complaining about. You think of a business is planning its capital expenditures, maybe 5, 10, mm-hmm. 20 years in advance, maybe longer. And so when you have this credit that's renewed, every year, every 2 years, and sometimes it lapses and sometimes it's renewed, there's always this question.
Right.
Companies just can't rely on it being there. And for them, that is a big, big, big hindrance, to research and to, trying to move forward with these new ideas.
All right. Very good. Well, as the time draws nearer for the decision to be made, would you be willing to come back and give us an update?
I'd be happy to.
His name is Matthew Caminiti. He's a BGov tax policy analyst with Bloomberg Government. And that just about does it for today. Thanks to Afzal Bari and Sopin Shaw for coming onto the program. All of their writings can be found, as usual, at www.bgov.com. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at BloombergGov. For show updates, feel free to follow me at Alan L. Scott. We'll get together again next Thursday, about 11 a.m. We'll have plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact, right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., I'm Alan Scott.